foggy.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday. It's the 14th of October, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. Hope you're having an enjoyable morning, and hopefully you are good to be with us for, I think, a rather rousing morning of discussion. We look forward to having it with you. The music we just heard was from the Chieftains. Paddy Maloney, the Irish folk music legend and founder of that group, the Chieftains, died on Tuesday at the age of 83. So we'll be playing Chieftains music this morning. We have a playlist, which is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. So that was a sad one. So we'll be listening to that music this morning in memory of Paddy Maloney. We welcome you again. All you have to do to get in and to be a part of our program is to write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. We just ask that you keep your letters short and to the point, and that way we can get to as many as possible. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning. Fresh from a taping of the Media Project. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe. It was a wonderful Media Project, but I have to say, the Chieftains news, really, very upsetting. I love that group and always have. And listened to them for years and years. And they do play the best in Irish music. Just wonderful.
Yeah, good stuff. And we'll be playing that this morning. And again, the playlist is listed there, and there's some really good stuff. So we remember Paddy Maloney this morning. Coho City Director of Operations Teresa Bourgeois joins us this morning. Teresa, how are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm doing well on this beautiful fall day. Colors are, leaves are turning, gorgeous colors. Life is good.
Life is good. And we thank you very much for being with us. It's always good to have you aboard. We also welcome Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I actually thought you were playing the Chieftains because we might be discussing the status of Northern Ireland.
Well,
in relation to,
I thought that too. I meaning in the sense of as we were right. As we say. Oh well, I said this goes together. I chose the Irish story, the Northern Ireland story prior, but yes, they do go hand in hand. So we'll certainly be addressing that a little bit later on. Hey, and look who has made it to our quorum. Rich Honan is here, corporate attorney,
hey.
And our good friend. Hello, Rich. We've missed you. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. What's new? What can you tell us about your life? What's happened?
Same as everybody else. Looking forward to getting back in the studio. So
yeah. Well,
lobbying for that.
I think that that's soon. That's soon.
Okay.
I will. Cool. I will. I don't think I'm tipping any cards by saying that will be within a matter of days. So.
Although I got to tell you, I was thinking it would be challenging to dance to what you were just playing.
We'll get a jig in by the end of the time.
You could do it.
Yeah.
Something a little more rollicking, maybe.
You could,
I don't know.
Definitely do that.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate you being here. It's always special. And I know you do not believe us when we tell you this. I know you do not believe us. But I do not think a day goes by where we do not get a note that said, "Where is Rich?" So
I actually do believe that.
Okay. No. No, I meant it in the good way, though. All right. It's good to have
nice
you.
Nice to hear everyone.
It's great to have you here, Rich. Thank you very much. All right. Let's get started. We'll talk about what's going on and have a discussion of where we are. I'll begin with the January 6th committee preparing to aggressively enforce subpoenas targeting former Trump DOJ officials. This is the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack. They're planning to ramp up its efforts to force Trump administration officials to cooperate with its inquiry. And on Wednesday, it issued a subpoena for a former Justice Department official, panel members, view as key to the examination of the former president's efforts to overturn election results. The committee said it is seeking records and testimony from Jeffrey Clark, a Trump-era Justice Department official who sought to deploy department resources to support President Donald Trump's claims of massive voting fraud in the 2020 election. The Select Committee needs to understand all the details about efforts inside the previous administration to delay the certification of the 2020 election and amplify misinformation about the election results. That coming from Committee Chairman Benny Thompson, the Democrat from Mississippi. We need to understand Mr. Clark's role in these efforts at the Justice Department and learn who was involved across the administration. The Select Committee expects Mr. Clark to cooperate fully with our investigation. This comes as many members, we should note, attorney for Mr. Clark declined to comment. The committee on Wednesday also took 8 hours of closed-door testimony from former Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen regarding the final days of the Trump administration, according to two people familiar with the meeting. They describe private testimony and also focuses on witnesses willing to voluntarily meet with the panel. And the final part of this that I'll throw in before I give it to the group, the latest activity comes as tensions over compliance with the investigation are increasing, and as the committee's plans to hold depositions this week are already facing headwinds, the focus of those depositions are Steve Bannon and three other Trump administration officials, former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, former Deputy Chief of Staff Dan Scavino, and Kash Patel, who was serving as Chief of Staff to then Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller on January 6th. Alan.
Well, to me, it's sort of a mystery which has been solved. We know why they're interviewing all these people, because they know about the guy who stood there and said, everybody up to the Capitol, go fight like hell, and who incited the riot. They know it. However, he has always dealt with executive privilege as if it's his all-time protection and right, so they have to go down the other way in the alley. And they get these guys who know what happened and who are able to say whether they were communicating with the president. That's what this is all about, clearly, to me. The mystery is solved. We know how it happened. But they need to get people to come forward and to open their yaps.
Rich Honan.
Joe, do you just take the front page of the New York Times and decide that's what the topics are going to be?
I would say that it's more than that.
No, because I was looking forward to, when I saw it was Teresa and Vera, I was like, I was thinking, you know, some really smart, really aggressive panelists. We have all these chunky issues to talk about with, you know, supply chain and mandates and Afghanistan and immigration.
You don't find this is a chunky issue?
No. I mean, I think they should subpoena everybody they need to subpoena, right? I mean, they want to have an investigation. I don't understand the controversy. I think it's about the 94th most important issue on the table today. But if you want to focus on it, yeah, they should subpoena whoever they need to subpoena. It's an investigation. You know, former administration, they should, sure. There's no other.
I don't see any
other way you can do an investigation.
Can you come back to me for a minute? Yes. Rich, first of all, thank you for being here. You always make the program better. However, I have to say, here is a guy, Trump, who wants to subvert the American democracy. What? The supply chain is competitive with that as a topic? No, this is the most important thing we could be talking about, because if he has his way, poof, there won't be what we've had in terms of our protections. And to do it this way, Joe, I think gets a lot of credit. I don't know.
I think I'll let the others talk, but I think you're confusing important with exigent. certainly anything that affects the fabric of the democracy is as important as it can be, but it's not an exigent issue, Alan. I mean, the other issues we have in front of us are timely. There's things going on now. There's it's things where conversation can still be had around the issues before they become fully formed. So,
well, I take a
but,
little.
You know,
I take
dig. It's fine.
I take a little umbrage to what you're saying, and I realize I'm probably being overly taking it personal. But I have to say, first of all, we have talked about the supply chain issues. We spent an hour on it 2 days ago. We've been talking about regular issues. The news of the day yesterday, and I will also take umbrage to the idea that it's whatever is on the front page of the New York Times. We go through a lot of different sources and see what is sticking. I think if you look generally at what is a main story today, because of the subpoenas and because of the testimony and because of the closed door activity that took place yesterday, that this story rises to the top and something that we should discuss. But I will turn over to Teresa Bourgeois.
Can I go one more time? Joe, can I go?
I share Rich's frustration that we have to be talking about this, but I do think we have to be talking about this because it is a real stress test on the fundamentals of our democracy. I mean, I think it would be much better for our country if we were really getting into a healthy discussion about the budget questions. I hope we do get to the solar energy and wind energy discussions. But I think that we do have our democracy is really threatened right now. I think for Trump, he keeps this up because he can raise money and it keeps him relevant. I think I don't have a deep enough understanding about what some of the forces are behind him that are driving this and, you know, where it's going and at what point do you cross a line that really creates some serious structural problems to our democracy. That's why I think as much as I and discouraged that we have to spend so much time talking about him in this, I do think we have a real problem in our democracy right now that needs to be addressed. And this is just a piece of it.
Alan, and then we'll go to Vera.
Very quickly, I did go to my dictionary to look up Rich's word exigent because I wasn't quite sure of the depth of it. So it's defined as pressing or demanding. And let me tell you, the takeover of our government by basically a guy with fascist tendencies seems to me to meet that definition rather well of pressing or demanding.
Vera.
So my contribution would be simple and straightforward. As a faculty member, I find increasingly that students and community members are beginning to doubt that the U.S. Government has any power to investigate what happened in a prior administration. So they don't understand depositions. They don't understand why people aren't, when they're served with papers to give testimony, why they are not responding to the select committee seeking records and testimony. There's a lot of discussion among young people not understanding how this process works. So in two ways, I find it important to discuss it. Number one, generally explaining to the general public, and in my case, to my students, how these processes work. And secondly, of course, to record historically through the collection of data and interviews and records and testimonies to put together a full account of what happened on January 6th. So in that sense, I find it exigent.
Vera, I'm glad we have the word of the day.
Yeah, the word of the day is exigent.
It's better than umbrage. I didn't mean to give umbrage, by the way. Vera, I'd be interested in knowing, what are the other I assume these are undergrads, right?
Yes.
For the most part, what are their other issues? What are the issues that you find them that kind of resonate with them?
So, in addition to all of those questions, how the system works, why it can't be enforced, how people can just not respond, right, to legal notices, or how they can disappear or hide behind legal claims. They don't really understand that, why that works for so long when it doesn't seem right or fair, you know, not to speak and give evidence. The other issue is the use of media, limits to media usage, manipulation of media, disinformation campaigns. That's essential to their conversations in the classrooms.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Rich Honan make up the panel this morning, and we will go to your letters, and we will move on to other topics as well throughout the morning. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after news from the BBC.
At the harvest fair, she'll be surely there, and I'll dress in my Sunday clothes. But my shoes shone bright, and my hot cock right, for a smile from a nut brown rose. No pot, bomb smoke, no horse, I'll yoke.
Good morning, welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Let's see, we'll go to some letters here. Kathy writes, does Rich think the insurrection on January 6th was good for our democracy? What does he think of all Trump's falsehoods about the presidential election and favoring an autocracy over democracy? Rich.
Yeah, I'm against that.
Okay. Alan is right, says Kevin. Welcome back, Rich. It took you all of 3 minutes to make my blood boil. Trump and Trumpism is a cancer on the body politic of the U.S. You don't ignore cancer for other issues. Not acknowledging this is the fundamental problem will only allow tumors to grow. Emily, comment for my dad, Rich. Surprisingly, I agree with him on this front. I'd argue that the topics like the Texas governor's blatant disregard for freedoms and democracy concerning abortion and vaccine mandate restrictions, yesterday's news by now, are currently more pressing and demanding than Trump and his cronies at this point.
Well, I love that comment. That's funny.
Be That's proud of your daughter.
I'm very proud of her.
Go ahead. Yeah.
But Rich, if you're concerned about what happened on January 6th, then why aren't you concerned about efforts to block getting a record and understanding of what happened on January 6th?
I am concerned, and I'm fine for the investigation proceeding apace, and I'm sure that there's people who are going to fight the people who are fighting the subpoenas. I happen to agree with Vera's students. It is maddening in any legal context how things that are supposed to be mandatory, like subpoenas and, you know, calls to appear in court, notices to report, notices to appear, whatever you want to call it, become almost like this is our opening offer. And then, you know, people, you know, negotiate from there. I agree with her students. I've never been able to satisfactorily explain why it takes so long to, you know, get things like that done. People do have the right to, you know, you have the right to move to quash or limit a subpoena, and that goes through the courts or, you know, whoever is the arbiter. But I think it's important, and I think that, the investigation should continue.
Do you think that the Trump or the former president should be more willing to turn over information?
I don't know what's been asked of him, so I don't know the scope of the subpoenas. I think he should be, he should be willing to turn over, you know, whatever he has, and he should be willing to talk about it, and they should be willing to subpoena everybody else who they think, had something to do with it on any side. And I'm not saying it's an unimportant issue. I'm just saying in the context of all the other things that are going on right now, and nothing is going to this isn't going to change. They're going to continue to fight the subpoenas. They'll eventually get the testimony out. They'll do their investigation. But I was just kind of looking forward to kind of jousting with Vera and you know, and Teresa on some of the more, you know, some of the other issues that, you know, I see going on right now. But it's fine. Let them do their investigation.
Do you think the Republicans are pressing this to create a distraction so that they don't have to be talking about infrastructure, the details of it, or the details of the other packages, or the fact that they're sitting on sidelines while the Democrats are trying to repair our economy?
I don't know that they are pressing it. I think the last thing the Republicans are trying to do is create a distraction. I think the last thing the Republicans are trying to do is take any focus off of Biden stumbling around and his list of, you know, manufactured crises. I think that I would guess, and I don't know. I defer. There's people with better political minds. I would think the Republicans or whoever is opposing the Biden administration would just kind of sit back and say, "Go, you guys just keep stumbling around, and because you're the best advertisement for, you know, us trying to take over the House next year." That's what I would think. I don't know internally what they're thinking.
Chris writes, "Yay, Rich, thank you for continuing to bring a rush of fresh air to the panel when you can. Wish you were on more frequently." Michael says it's the Republican strategy to push this issue to 94th place, as Rich says. They don't want to talk about it because they have no defense of their leader instigating violence against the American people. Let's go to... let's see. So I want to talk about the Biden administration's plan for wind farms along nearly the entire U.S. coastline. The Interior Secretary announced that the agency will formally begin the process of identifying federal waters to lease to wind developers by 2025. Speaking at a wind power industry conference in Boston, the secretary said that the agency will begin to identify and demarcate and hope to eventually lease federal waters in the Gulf of Mexico, Gulf of Maine, and off the coast of the Mid-Atlantic states, North Carolina and South Carolina, California and Oregon to wind power developers by 2025. The announcement comes months after the Biden administration approved the nation's first major commercial offshore wind farm off the coast of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, and began reviewing a dozen other potential offshore wind projects along the East Coast. Alan.
Well, I love the idea that they went to Martha's Vineyard first. That will certainly PO some of the people who see that as the ultimate sanctuary of, you know, wealth and privilege and I don't want to start a fight there, but as you all know, I'm a bit of a Fire Islander, and I'd like to see the same thing happening there. Look, the way that we're going to save ourselves is by having energy production that comes from something that is as harmless as that is, in contradistinction to the, my favorite word, to the way in which we produce energy now, the fossil fuels. So I love it. I think it's great. I don't think there's any negative side to it. And Roselle and I were riding along the other day, and we saw one of these giant things. I think it was off the I-90 in Massachusetts. It was beautiful. It was like looking into the fire. You know, you just couldn't stop looking at it.
Vera?
Yeah, so I want to add a comparative perspective because obviously, as people might suspect, I'm also in favor of wind power. The reason I say it, because I've visited wind power sites in Germany. They're very common in Germany and then, you know, Netherlands, the UK, Norway. You have them set up on the North Sea and Baltic Sea. What you do is extensive studies to make sure it doesn't affect the tourism industry. It doesn't affect if there are any archaeological site underground in the water and so on. Germany has done this for many, many years, over a decade. we now have in Germany 1/4 of our power generated by wind turbines. The essential issue is that way you can replace fossil fuels and obviously also nuclear power, which has been the fundamental issue in Germany, because Germany ended nuclear power production in its own country. And so here we are looking at dramatic changes within the sort of Central European context in terms of power production through the wind turbines. What's interesting is that most of the surrounding countries are also pursuing the same strategy. It was initially controversial because investments were more expensive. The costs have come down. Then obviously you have to consider coastal animal life. Fisheries tend to be opposed to some of the fishing industry tends to be opposed, and tourism tends to be opposed if the sites selected are problematic for them. That again has to be negotiated and studied and researched. So the United States is behind in terms of pursuing wind turbines, but it is a very good option to go forward. It will help create a new dynamic industry, and obviously for a number of reasons, I'm in favor of it.
Rich?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with everything Vera said. My understanding, and I've always said this, you know, renewables, alternative sources of power, you know, the venture capitalists, the entrepreneurs, you know, they're all about that. You know, there's just a huge amount of innovation and money that's going on. My understanding, and I'm not an expert on anything, but not this. My understanding is that one of the delays, one of the reasons why the United States is behind, is once you've kind of gotten freed up the land, I think there's still a fairly lengthy process. You know, kind of your typical environmental, you know, whether it's a CEQA process or there's a long process to getting all of the permits you need, both from an environmental and regulatory standpoint, as well as kind of the surrounding, you know, the surrounding neighbors and you know, the effects on them. And that's been one of the delays that has kind of slowed things down in the United States. I don't know if this latest proposal also includes kind of ways of short-circuiting some of those delays. I don't know if it's that far along yet or not.
Teresa.
I think the best news here is that this administration is intensely focusing on renewable energy options, setting some very firm goals, and then working it across departments, agencies, and so on and so forth, which may seem obvious, but I think there had been a lot of stovepiping before, and so this is, based on what I read, you know, this is some breakthrough in that regard. I don't know enough about the environmental impacts of wind farms and oceans to really speak on this specifically, but I do know that we need to do much, much more with renewables. And I know I've spent the last year and a half for the city of Cahoos working on a project which will be the first of its kind in the country on floating solar and floating solar panels on a human-made water reservoir. So you don't have to worry about disrupting natural resource. It's a human-made water reservoir. And there's a national study from a DOE-funded organization that says, you know, there are 24,000 of these around the country, and they could generate 10% of our electric energy needs with clean power if we tap just this floating solar. So I can imagine the capacity for wind farms. You'd much rather, I think, a wind farm than an oil rig out in the ocean. But I do think, as Rich points to, there's a lot of steps in this process. But there also is potential for enormous other innovation. I worked with a professor when I worked at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Her name is Dr. Anna Dyson. She's now at Yale. But she's looking at the design of building envelopes, and could windows and buildings become, you know, essentially solar panels. So you don't have to go to these offshore farms or use up farmland. the exciting thing is I think that all of these areas will be an acceleration of innovation, of investment to find new ways. And then just to get a little bit more wonky on this, the other piece of this, though, that has to be dealt with is the electric grid, the power grid, and its capacity, carrying capacity. It's really complicated. It's going to need a lot of work, and it needs to be done to take advantage of these renewables.
Yeah, let me just second that as well. It's almost like with a lot of the renewables, the generation is less of the issue. It's the storage and the distribution. Particularly, you know, on the solar side, but you know, also with wind, so you see a lot of the visible innovation is on the generation, actually generating the power, but storing it and then distributing it, and with the increasing emphasis on electricity, you know, electric vehicles and everything and things like that, and the increasing awareness of the fragility of the grid, I think that could be one of the choke points. You know, I think the other political choke point here is it'll be interesting to see when these projects get far enough along to where they're now seeking environmental approval, and then you might have two political groups kind of opposing each other who are usually on the same side, right? So you're going to have the renewable people now being opposed to the environmental people and see kind of how, you know, who threads that needle. But it's a real good first step. Let's see where it goes.
So maybe, Rich,
right.
I think
it's important
speak
to be
to
having
that.
The discussion, though, and to begin to work out those things and see if there are other ways, like, you know, floating solar on municipal, you know, water bodies where it's, you know, these are human made, so you don't have these environmental issues. Where are the innovations? But the, you know, this connection to the grid, someone at the state agency NYSERDA told us, you know, those are where good ideas go to die, to try to make that connection. And it's true, it's complicated, but it needs to be figured out. And the great news is that, and this is where we need to get back to the infrastructure bill and the other bills that are pending in the Congress, there's an awful lot of resources. I've read the Department of Energy funding bill, tremendous support in there to drive, to accelerate getting answers to these questions, because we absolutely need them.
Vera, I want to come to you. I do have to take a break. Do you mind if I do that and then come right back to you?
I agree 100% with what Teresa said. It was very, very similar in a comparative case with Germany. Just the same arguments were made in Germany, and infrastructure bills were approved, and the grid connection was established. So it can be done. We have the technology if we get infrastructure bills through. That was it.
I'll take agreement when we can get it. So we'll pause there. We'll be right back. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 14th day of October. It is a Thursday morning. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Vera Carias-Kelly, and Rich Honan on our program. We welcome your input, panel@WAMC.org. Let's go to some letters here before we have to take a top of the hour break. Barbara says, title, T-I-D-A-L, free, dependable, predictable, eternal movement of trillions of tons of seawater twice a day. Harness this, and who needs a windmill? That is from Barbara. Then, on the issue
Joe,
of... Yes?
Joe, if I could have the floor for just one moment here. You know, we're getting a lot of letters about Rich. Let me just say, as the guy who thought up the round table and the panel, the idea of a panel is that you get different ideas. Now, 76 million, something like that, 73 million people voted for Donald Trump. If this is to be a true panel, you got to hear what the other guys have to say. I don't agree with much of what Rich says, and yet we value him, and we always ask him to be on. He's not on, not because of us, but because of him. And the more he's on, the better I like it, frankly, because I do believe that these issues and what people are thinking about them and why they're thinking about them are so important. And that's all I got to say.
All right.
Can I say something on tidal energy? I think tidal wave energy is a fantastic future opportunity. We do not have all of the technology yet. It's up and coming, and I think it's exactly right. It's significantly more reliable than both wind and sun energy. So that's where the future is, but it's not exactly fully operational at the moment.
Yeah,
Rich works a lot on innovation, but I think we are, once there's an intense focus on clean energy, there's just enormous potential for extraordinary acceleration of innovation in these areas, which will create jobs, it will create new wealth, it creates new opportunity. It's just, we are talking with the community colleges and others about what's the pipeline for workers and we're talking with our school district for these clean energy jobs and innovation. And it's just enormous, whether it's tidal, solar, floating, whatever. There's so much opportunity. Rich, you work with a lot of innovation. You could probably speak better to this, right?
Yeah, I agree. I think that you said it exactly right. Tidal itself is tough just because it's hard to build the plants. It's hard to find a place to build them, and then it's hard to build them. And, it's a force that's really powerful but really slow. I think there's some unknowns. There's some unknowns about the effect on sea life and things like that that are just legit difficult issues. I think when it comes to renewables and innovation, one of the things we've seen is once you can get a renewable energy idea into the everyday economy, mm-hmm. you build a lot around that. And I think the best example is electric vehicles. And the amount of innovation that I see, even here in Albany, in upstate New York, USA, the amount of innovation that is going on around things that support electric vehicles. And it's not just, making the cars and making the batteries and the energy storage. It's the charging stations, and it's the mapping, and it's the, putting together the locations for people trying to find stations. There's so many the people with the company in Syracuse that does the portable, basically extra battery. There's so much that gets built around it once something becomes synthesized into the economy, and that's what you're trying to see. And so once you actually get, to our point before, once you actually get wind farms, for example, on the grid, and people are building software and equipment right around that's when things really take off. But it's hard. Believe me, there's nobody standing in the way of it, because the environment, the greenies all love it, and the capitalists all love it, and it's just hard to do, but it's definitely the way to go.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many letters on this subject, and we have other stuff to talk about, so we'll do all of that when we return. First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Rich Onan, and Vera Carius Kelly with us this morning. Let's go to some letters that we have on our topic of renewables and wind power, and then we'll move on to other subjects. Jim says, I wish those who are in favor of huge wind turbines and massive solar farms would realize how they will negatively impact only those who live in the scenic rural areas of our country. Apparently, the rural folk don't matter so much. These structures are hardly harmless. And yes, there are, in fact, lots of negative downsides beyond destroying scenic vistas and cutting down vast swaths of carbon-eating forest to install solar farms. There is 20-megawatt solar farm being installed on a hillside near our lakeside cabin. And to say it is not pretty is being kind. Renewables are simply not all they are cracked up to be. That is a perspective from Jim. We go to Betsy, I'm sorry, we go to John, who says, I am all for developing alternate sources of energy production. At the same time, however, might we be working on diminishing the cause of the problem, our culture's overconsumption of all resources by an ever-booming, out-of-control population? Discourage large families, for instance, or excessive carbon-based travel. All right. You heard her.
Joe, can I?
Less sex. Go ahead. Yes.
But I do think the reason I mentioned this Professor Dyson I work with wants us to rethink what we call the building envelope windows, everything, because I thought that she really posed some important questions. Do you need these large solar farms? Do you need these large wind farms? Can you take the structures we have and essentially turn them into solar collectors? Or, energy collectors in a different way. And I think that that's an important question to ask because there is a lot of pressure being put on farmland. You see that in the newspaper stories in upstate New York. It's essential that we move toward renewables, but we have to be creative in the way that we do it and take into account, the full life cycle impacts of these and the way the good with the bad and see where the innovation is. But as Rich pointed out, the key to a lot of this, unlocking this, is storage. And we need a lot more innovation in storage. And that gets back to why we need to pass this infrastructure bill and this larger portions of this larger spending bill focused on clean energy, because we need to unlock those answers pretty quickly.
Betsy writes, Rich is wrong that there is no impediment from business over clean energy. There is plenty that stands in the way, and it's not the technologies. It's the energy companies and utilities. Good example is the fight over rooftop solar in Arizona, where the utilities actually stopped rooftop solar from connecting to the grid, essentially halting such projects in Arizona, where solar should be the dominant energy producer. James writes, I'm not an engineer, but it seems to me that the current electricity distribution model is backwards. Rather than having companies distribute electricity for a fee, shouldn't the ultimate goal be to have Hive input into the grid? In other words, every house, apartment complex, business have solar panels, wind, etc., to provide for their own use and any extra fed back into the grid.
Yeah, and by the way, a lot of people are thinking about that idea as well. Obviously, certainly there's lots of people with solar panels who are sending energy back onto the grid. But to Teresa's point, that the more you can do that kind of on a consumer individual basis. And maybe you have solar panels on your house, maybe you have some kind of, windmill or something. People are looking at that as well, basically you supporting the grid rather than the grid supporting you. I will say that the letters demonstrate, the difference of ideas on this, right? It's all legit. Even in those few letters, it kind of stakes out, the spectrum of views on this. It's difficult.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a wide swath, no question about it.
But the importance is that the conversation is now being had, right? We're talking through these issues, and that's how we get to some solutions and some new innovations and such. And of course, as one of the writers mentioned, the one of the key things is to reduce consumption, right? To make our buildings as energy efficient as possible, to have more walkable cities, to rethink, to rethink how we live, work, and play, to do it in a way that is as energy efficient as possible, and that the energy we are using is derived as much as possible from renewables is the key.
And yeah, I think one of the other things to consider is also the fact who is part of, the larger governing structure or the advancement of investments in these alternative energies. In the United States, it can sometimes be private individuals who decide to have a massive solar energy plant in the middle of an area that is otherwise used for recreational purposes. And that is really problematic because private industry might not consult as much with other landowners or other interests, whereas that's why I think in Germany there was a coalition built between environmentalists, alternative energy advocates, the government, and private interests to come up with specific ideas of where you could build wind turbines and what areas would be least impactful in terms of, disadvantaging the tourism industry or private landholders or the concerns of environmental activists. So this is a very big conversation we have to have in this country, and we haven't had it because it was sort of a piecemeal approach so far.
I think that's insightful. I'm sorry, Alan, go ahead.
No, you please, Rich.
I think that's a really insightful point about the difference between kind of the European approach and the American approach, where One of the things about Europe is there is, and I know it's hard to make a big generalization, but there is much more of an openness to kind of public-private partnerships where there may be less, I'll say more acceptance by business of working with the government, especially in the European Union. Whereas you don't have that as much, in the United States, it's always, we're always saying, oh, let us do it and, get the government out of our way, which works in some things. But in things like this where you need environmental regulation and compliance and oversight, it works better when you have those kind of partnerships. And I think that's one of the reasons, Vera, why you do see things moving on this side. You see things moving much more quickly in places like Germany and Norway and the Scandinavian countries, right. Whereas here government and business don't always play that well together. And this is really an area where they need to, because of the oversight that's needed.
Alan?
I actually agree with that. I think NIMBYism is really alive and well in this country. We hear from the people on the islands, Nantucket and others. We hear it from the people who are living on lakes. It's okay to have all of this until it affects me and what I have. And I think that is something. I mean, I'm not going to even talk to the European model versus the United States because, frankly, I don't know that much about it. But I do know NIMBYism when I see it, and we got it, and we got it a lot.
Well, that's part of our – in a way, that's part of our culture, right? That's part of our, the idea of, private property and people stake, having their independence and staking out their claim and homesteading, it goes back to the Homestead Act, right? And that's a little bit part of who we are. And there's some really good things about that. But it presents some challenges, and that's one of them. I think you have less of that in areas where there's more of, and I'm not saying this in a political way, but kind of more of a socialistic culture, a little more acceptance of that. Whereas here, we're much more into individual rights, property rights, and it's going to create some of that NIMBYism that you talk about, Alan.
Well, it's not going to change unless we change it. Look, yes, please, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
But I also think that these are important questions to ask because, what's the tipping point when you should not be using up farmland to turn them into solar farms? Where's the balance there? And also, and again, speaking from my limited experience here on our floating solar project, the funding streams really make a difference because right now for solar, all of the state and federal funding is tax credits. And so that provides incentives for private investors to come in and invest and install these floating solar panels, raise whatever, rooftop, wherever. But for a city like ours, we want to have owned and operated. But there's no equivalent grant funding stream for that. But should there be? And with this, Congressman Tonko is helping us ask this question. Because then the economic benefits go not to the investors, but back to the city.
And for us, we'll have $500,000 a year back into our economy. And as a working class community, that's important. So I think all of these questions need to be worked through and to figure out, you know, what is the best route to incentivize clean, renewable energy in the most innovative, cost-effective way.
Hey, Joe, I don't want to get you too off the... Go ahead.
Okay.
Okay, I just want to say quickly on the solar issue, right? We have to have more conversations also about the solar waste that's projected, because we know that the solar panels can't be fully recycled, and then the heavy metals that are in the solar panels, lead and cadmium, leach out of the cells and get into the groundwater. So they're serious questions that should be publicly discussed rather than decide what you incentivize through tax credits rather than evaluate what all the side effects are to choose one over another process in the country.
So how do they do it in Germany?
Well, so we have solar waste projects that are led in private government partnership to study the impact, and that's why also a significant shift was happening towards you know, wind turbines because of the heavy metals in the solar panels, by the way.
Yeah, also the political situation now, because so much solar panels came out of China, and now there people are looking for second sources. That's driving some other alternative. I will say, I have to say, the corporate lawyer in me, Teresa, says there. That strikes me as there's got to be a sale leaseback type of solution there, where the private companies get the tax benefits, but working with the sale leaseback, they're able to pass some of those actual dollars onto the municipality. So that's just speaking as a lawyer.
I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on this, but the gains for the city, for the municipality, are far, far less that way. And it's much more economically beneficial over time. On the front end, you get it installed if you do the 40% tax break for the private investor. But on the back end, after the second, third, fourth year, and you go 20 years on these, you know, they're 16, 18 years of it, which the city does not nearly benefit in the way that they would otherwise. Mm-hmm. This is the national model we're working to create, and that Congressman Tonko has helped champion for us in hearings in Washington and in discussions, even up to the Secretary of Energy, he raised this with her. So, you know, the funding streams are really, really important. But these environmental questions that Vera raises are also important. What's the full life cycle cost of these? What happens in the end? And as you say, Rich, where these are built right now, it's Vietnam and China. We need to develop a source of solar panels in the United States, right? Because we're going to need to use a lot more of them, and we you know, need to be manufactured here in our country.
Yeah, and oddly, some of the tariffs from you know, many administrations ago and continuing over other administrations, some of the tariffs meant to actually strike at China actually have come to hurt some of the importing that we need, because we don't have a lot of the raw materials and the heavy metals needed here. I think what this all points to, and I think Vera made the point, well, both of you actually, Vera and Teresa, that, you know, there's balances, and it's hard for us here in the United States in this day and age to come up with solutions that have to involve a constantly readjusting balance. There's such a desire for kind of a rule, you know, that says we're going to do it this way. You know, I'm not going to say one size fits all, but, you know, there's such a desire for rules, whereas a lot of this, you can't do a single rule. You can't do it's got to be more of, you know, just what was brought up before. Yeah, we'd like to see more wind farms, but we need farmland, you know, and there's no overall rule that you could posit that fixes that. You have to take into account each of the differing facts and circumstances, but then people have to constantly be communicating and working together, and those are not the type of solutions that we have traditionally looked for. We've looked for more like the kind of on both sides, you know, just like the overall pronouncement, you know, thou shalt do it this way, and then everybody follows along.
Right.
And, you know, when you
really,
when you think about...
Go ahead.
When you think politically about the situations, too, when you have a parliamentary democracy where you have to build coalition governments that models finding negotiated approaches, and you have to let go of your ideological narrowness sometimes a little bit on the edges to come up with a collaborative arrangement for a governing principle. And here in the United States, because we have seen this sort of, you know, polarization intensify, this also makes it more difficult to get, you know, to put in place the processes necessary to negotiate
around. I think that's fascinating. And I agree with you on that. And I think the fascinating thing is, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but I didn't want to lose the thought. Aren't we seeing that right now? And I'm not saying this in a political way. What's going on the reconciliation bill among the Democratic Party is a lot like the European model of coalitions in a parliament. Now suddenly, you know, the Progressive Party, it has, you know, really the bulk of the seats, if you want to call it that, right? Isn't the Progressive Party the largest single caucus in the Democratic Party? And now they're being forced to kind of work together and build kind of intra-party coalitions between the progressives and some moderates and maybe some others. And it's exactly what you're talking about, but we're seeing a microcosm of that right now within the Democratic Party itself.
Except for in Europe, what you have when you see such diversity within parties, they do tend to break up and create new parties. That's why in the late 70s, you, for example, saw the Green Party, which used to be members of the Social Democrats, break off, form a separate party, and now they have matured into a full party with significant political support. That's why we have a multi-party system when the big tent approach, in essence, no longer satisfies certain constituents. They can form their own party, and some rise and some disappear. This is a super difficult process to succeed in within the U.S. system. That's why we have these parties that are experiencing extreme tensions within, or they simply exclude constituencies or voices and don't represent the full spectrum of their potential voters. I think the two-party system is a real problem in this country.
Teresa?
But, Barrett, isn't one of the issues if the Republicans are sitting on the sidelines on the issue side of this discussion and they think that's good politics for them? But, I mean, I think one of the challenges and that needs to happen is that Republicans have to be drawn into this conversation that, you know, what is their solution to the climate issue? And, you know, how long are they going to sit on the sidelines on the climate issue, on the daycare issue, on the jobs creation issue? They're just being allowed to sit on the sidelines and say, we're not going to play. But that's not governing. And that has a price that they
Well, that's exactly the point. They can just wait
that's
it out,
point
Teresa.
Making.
That is the problem with the United States. If you have only one opposition party, you can just sit there and offer no solution and wait out for the internal implosion of the other party. I mean, that's what the two parties do. There's no governing in that sense, as you would expect, finding a solution, you know, to particular environmental problems.
I will say that it would be interesting to see if there are kind of break off splinter factions of any of those parties, and to see whether, for example, you see, you know, to Teresa's point, whether you see some Republicans in the House maybe moving over to, I don't know where, to the moderates or maybe, you know, to work together, just because the margins are so razor thin and getting thinner that, you know, a few people can make a difference. The other thing is there, you know, I saw the other day, I think it's Representative Ro Khanna from the Silicon Valley area, and who's a Democrat with a Republican, Mace, is it Nancy Mace? She was, I think, the first woman to go to the Citadel, I think. They're co-sponsoring a bill on cybersecurity together, and pushing the bill together. It was kind of cool to actually see it. I don't know where the bill's going, but you know, left-wing Silicon Valley guy, right-wing, I guess, South Carolina Republican, and, finding some daylight there to kind of work together.
All right, folks, we're going to...
You saw the infrastructure bill. Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. So we're going to take a break. We have to go for a break, and when we come back, we'll continue. Rich, I know you have to leave at 10:30, so thank you very much for being with us.
It was great, great talking to everybody. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to seeing everybody in the studio. And just so everybody knows, you guys do invite me all the time, and I appreciate it. And, when we're back live, I'll be looking forward to seeing everybody.
All right. Rich, thanks very much for being with us. We'll take a break.
Great
when we
to
can...
have you back, Rich.
We'll
great talking to you.
Be back right after this.
Take care.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you all with us, Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, and Vera Karius-Kelly. We do welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Let's get to as many topics as we can in our few moments left. There is a lot to talk about. We will talk about, since we have been listening to beautiful Irish music this morning, we will talk about the EU offering UK concessions on Northern Ireland. Here is what the spat is about. Britain is demanding an end to post-Brexit rules known as the Northern Ireland Protocol. The European Union sees the rules as a key part of protecting its single market. I don't think I am editorializing here other than to say that from the very beginning of Brexit, there were great questions as to how this would impact Northern Ireland and Ireland. And so we're still seeing great questions and great question marks remain. For months, this battle over the status of Northern Ireland has been the thorniest legacy of Brexit, even sparking a conflict known as the Sausage Wars. Now Britain has upped the ante by demanding that post-Brexit trade rules for Northern Ireland that it agreed to 2 years ago be scrapped and replaced. The European Union responded to that call this week with a far-reaching plan to resolve practical problems raised by the Brexit treaty, the Northern Ireland Protocol, that has provoked a full-scale confrontation between Britain and the bloc. It is a spat that could upset the United States. The protocol aims to resolve one of the most complex issues created by Brexit, what to do about the border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, and the Republic of Ireland, which remains part of the European Union. According to the new proposal from Brussels, checks on food and animal products going from mainland Britain to Northern Ireland would be reduced by 80%. Customs paperwork for shipments of many goods would be slashed, and the flow of medicines would be ensured. All right. There are a lot of different places to go here, but Alan, let you start off, and then we'll go around the room.
There should be one Ireland, period. There should be the Republic, and this is a golden opportunity to fold Northern Ireland into the Irish Republic. I'm all for it. At one point or another, we're going to have to talk to the outstanding guy in the United States Congress on this, and that's Richie Neal, who has been telling the WAMC audience what's going on. I think there's a lot of stuff to be sorted out here. But certainly when the Brits decided to get involved in Brexit the way that they did, they certainly knew what the rules were going to be, and now they don't like it.
Vera.
So, Boris Johnson, he is a bomb thrower. He's a bomb thrower. What he just did was basically say, I don't care what I agreed to years ago. Make it go away, because I don't really care what the demands have been in the past or what I negotiated or the government negotiated. I want new rules. The new rules that he wants is basically to not be part of the European Union, but have the advantage of being part of the economic union. He wants to not have the European Court of Justice as the top court regarding the Republic of Ireland, which is a member of the European Union, and Northern Ireland, which is obviously the part of, the formerly Irish Republic that is now part of the UK. So he doesn't want disputes between economic or border disputes between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland to be heard and judged within the European Court of Justice, which was also agreed upon. So what does he want? He wants to shake loose the best arrangement for the UK, despite all of the issues that he created for the population of the UK to, when he supported the withdrawal from the European Union. It's a really interesting negotiation technique Johnson is pursuing. He wants a better deal. The European Union is basically saying, okay, we're going to adjust some of your practical issues, but we're certainly not relitigating the arrangement that we currently have with the UK. So it's a really serious issue, because if you can't trust the British government to negotiate in good faith, and every 2 years they come up with a new arrangement that they'd like to pursue and renegotiate, it's a real problem.
And the call, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Vera, but much of the concern of what you were saying, not to repeat what you just said, but much of the concern from the very beginning is that Johnson would say whatever he needed to say at the time to get this passed and to placate both the Irish and the Northern Irish people. Now that the rubber's hitting the road and something actually has to be done, saying, well, let's scrap it and start all over again, where both parties have been working hard to implement what was actually being worked on.
Right. I mean, this is a really big issue in terms of future relationships between the UK and can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. I just heard the sound and I thought, no,
you're good.
I'm disconnected.
No.
So this is a really big deal in terms of how the relationship in the future looks between the UK, the European Union, and along the Irish border with Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. I mean, the Republic of Ireland obviously, overwhelmingly, finds it quite disturbing that the voices of those that wanted to remain in the European Union in Northern Ireland were denied that right simply because they're a smaller population. That's why a lot of people talked about when they initially had the Brexit referendum in the UK about a democratic gap, because minority communities did not have enough voices to override the decision made in the center. And the same has, of course, affected Scottish population, who also were agitating for maybe a new future. So this is all about the future of populations who want to be part of a larger union with the European Union and feel that the center in London is narrowing their opportunities. And that's aggravating people.
Can I tap into your expertise on this? And I said a line, there was a line in the Times article that I read just a moment ago and talked about what impact this would have on the United States. Could you talk a little bit about that impact?
So one thing to remember is that the United States was heavily involved in the Good Friday Peace Agreement that was signed in 1998. And that is an agreement that led to an arrangement that reduced violence among Northern Irish populations and those that are called the Unionists, the ones that are loyal to the London government. And so all negotiations from then on have focused on trying to reduce sectarian and economic tensions between the Irish populations interested in unifying with the Republic of Ireland and those populations living in Northern Ireland that are interested in having Northern Ireland be part of the UK. So the United States has a huge stake in maintaining peace. And what Boris Johnson is doing at the moment is trying to weaken that peace agreement. And a lot of Irish Americans are deeply concerned, including President Biden, about what might be happening if Northern Irish organizations reignite, because out of anger, out of disillusionment, attacks on members that are loyal to the British government.
And I think it's fair to say, I mean, not to the level that we have seen over the past several decades, but those tensions have already ignited. We have already seen large swaths of violence and for a sustained period of time over the last 2 years.
Yes. Yes, I would agree. It's on the uptick. And this whole issue related to the status of Northern Ireland and the population's opportunities to access the European Union market was at the center of the negotiation to avoid a full outbreak of violent clashes. And the United States government is deeply concerned about that potential and has a big stake in keeping peace.
We have about 2 minutes. Teresa, I want you to weigh in on this as well.
Well, I really bow to Vera's expertise on this and have enjoyed listening to her. I think that, you know, just reiterating the shorthand is that the rhetoric is clashing with the reality, and it's causing a lot of tensions in ways that probably should have been anticipated, but were not. And, you know, the details matter. And this idea of this, you know, Northern Ireland new border, essentially, you know, these checking of goods and entering Northern Ireland creates a whole series of new tensions, as she's pointing out, that have really long term. I mean, it took a long time to get to where we are in terms of dealing with the troubles and in Ireland, you know, and to have this put strains on that is a real problem. You know, I think that they went in this direction without thinking through the details of how it would actually work. And as Vera says, they now want it both ways, and you can't have it both ways.
We are out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us. Alan, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Hello.
Teresa Bourgeois and Vera Karius-Kelly, so nice to have you. Thanks again to Rich Honan. We'll be back with the Congressional Corner right after this.